Genesis 22. Last time we were looking at Genesis 20 and 21, where we've left, you know, Lot in 19 and the situation he found himself in. We moved on into 21, where even Abraham gets himself, in chapter 20, Abraham gets himself into some trouble. With Abimelech, we talked about that, and God preserved Sarah even in the midst of that. As we went over into chapter 21, really big text, isn't it? This is where we see the fulfillment of the promise God made 25 years before. God fulfills in giving Abraham and Sarah Isaac. And so he's born, and he is the answer to that promise. We also saw in chapter 21 how God protected Hagar and Ishmael, that God didn't leave them to the wind, but God protected them, and how it was through Ishmael's generations that his family flourished and would become a great nation as well. I'm not going to cover this in the class, but very much. But if you go to the end of chapter 21, Abraham makes a covenant with Abimelech. You remember he just had some issues with Abimelech. But one of the neat things is, interesting things to study, is that even after Abraham lied about Sarah to him, or was dishonest at least, with Abimelech, he allowed Abraham to continue to live in the land. He didn't cast him out as the Egyptians had done. And so as you get into 21, they make a treaty together. Abimelech wants to make this treaty with Abraham because he sees that Abraham is being blessed by God, by Yahweh. So I'll let you go back and read that and read through it and study it. I want to go to chapter 22 and talk about this very important text, So let's go to 22, and I want to read just a little bit. We'll talk about it, and you all feel free to ask questions along the way or correct me if I get something wrong. But let's look at 22, verse 1. The text says, "After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, 'Abraham,' and he said, 'Here am I.' He said, 'God, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you.'" All right, there's a lot just in those two verses. Before we get into the actions of Abraham, let's just look at God. In verse number one, some texts may have the word tempted. Anybody have that? King James probably has tempted. Newer translations probably will have the word tested. In this instance, the Hebrew is tested, not tempted. And there's a biblical reason why we know that has to be the case. Anybody know? James chapter 1, right? What does James 1 and verse 12 say? Yeah, let no man say when he's tempted that he's tempted by God, because God cannot be tempted with evil, nor does he tempt anyone. So let me ask this question just more broadly. What would you say is the difference between the word test and the word tempt? It's kind of pivotal. How would you define that terminology in your mind, biblically speaking? Well, what do you think the difference in those two are?
Taking aside the evil, something that is not necessarily approved by the person testing you, whereas testing is just trying to find out where you stand as far as, or how prepared are you for another step?
Okay.
Where do you actually sit? How prepared are you for working something down the road?
Okay, so your employer is probably going to test you, aren't they? Especially if you have a real important job, you're going to be tested. They're going to know that you're going to be able to fulfill what you're doing. Are they tempting you? They're not tempting you. They're testing you. Good thought. Who wants to add to that?
It was qualifying you to
There's a qualifying.
Testing, I guess, at least is the way we use it within the nuclear field, and that's qualifying.
Mm-hmm.
Testing is your knowledge, your abilities, are you qualified to do it? And you can't work on things unless you're qualified.
Yeah.
To develop those skills. That's the way you want to live in.
And exactly. And so you think about those two terms. Temptation has a necessary component to it, which is what? The outcome of tempting, if it's given into, always results in what? Well, we're talking about, biblically speaking, evil, right? Evil. Now, I know sometimes we say, man, that chocolate in the cabinet's really tempting me, right? You go and eat that chocolate bar, it may make you feel bad. Is that sin in the biblical sense? I don't think that's sin. I guess it could be in a particular context, but that's we don't always use it in that same kind of way. But biblically speaking, temptation always, if given into, ends in sin. However, testing, does it always end in sin? No, and I don't even know that most of the time it ends in sin, right? We can be tested.
If Abraham had chosen not to do what God said, then in fact he would have sinned.
Yeah, that's true.
And so, God, in a sense, tests everybody in that he gives commandments. Do not do this, do that. If you do those things, then you're approved. If you don't do those things, you're sinned.
Mm-hmm. So I guess I requalify what I was trying to say there, which is right, is if we fulfill the test, that's not leading to sin, it's we're accomplishing something. So take athletics, right? An Olympian, their events test them, right? There's a certain test to their physical abilities, to their training, and those kind of things. You think of temptation, I might think about Satan in the garden as the serpent, right? That's temptation. He's trying to lead Eve into sin. And that was his motive. And so I think that word motive is important as well. Motive is important behind this. God, in testing Abraham, is not trying to lead him to sin. He's trying to prove his faith. And we'll see that as we move forward. The desire to do evil, right? Yeah. So I wanted to deal with that first. As we continue, we're looking at this. The proper translation is the word test. God is trying to test Abraham. And so Abraham answers the call in verse 1. He says, God says, Abraham, and then Abraham says, here am I. Another kind of thing that's hard for us to relate to is God speaking to Abraham. That's kind of an amazing thing just in itself.
God calls Samuel. He's not manifesting himself in any other way, but you hear the voice.
Yeah. Some translations, let me just say this, may have the angel of the Lord there in verse number 1. And the indication seems to be this is God, right? Not an angel in this particular context. And so verse 2, he says, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah. Offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. So this son, whom we just one chapter, was born and was the answer to a promise. Now God is saying, take that child and offer him as a sacrifice. It's interesting, those chapters are right side by side with each other. These texts are so close by. From what I understand, many believe that Isaac is probably, what I've heard, and these are estimates, so you can do your own study, but is probably around 12 years old, is the thought here. He's not like a young child. And so God is asking him to go to the land of Moriah. Now, Some have theorized that, and even claim that this is the same location where the temple would be erected eventually. But that's hard to note for a couple reasons. One, when it talks about this mountain, it's not a singular mountain. It's like you're traveling along and then there's just one mountain, like you're traveling to Mount Pilate or Pilot Mountain. I guess that's Andy Griffith's Mount Pilate. But Pilot Mountain, you know, and it just pops out there and it's this very unique mountain, you know, or hill or whatever you want to call it, sitting there, right? That's very distinct. This was a mountain range. It's like Mount Sinai. It's going to be very hard to find Mount Sinai. Why? Because it's part of a mountain range. So whether or not they actually built the temple there, it's your guess. Your guess is as good as anybody probably. But he's called to go there and to offer him as a burnt offering. A burnt offering. What are we talking about? So we're not talking about the law of Moses here, are we? This wouldn't have been a sacrifice that would have been known to whom? The patriarchs, right? It would have been something they were very familiar with. We'll talk more about that as we move on. But he's called to go there to offer him in this burnt offering to sacrifice him to God. Now, there's a problem with that if God's intention is really to have Isaac sacrificed, isn't it?
Yes.
What's the problem?
Who said not to do that before?
Not to do that? It becomes a real problem for the children of Israel, doesn't it?
Yes.
I brought up
King Ahaz this morning. You know what one of his great sins was? He offered children to Moloch, his own children. And I find it interesting that when God is talking of his disgust about the child sacrifice of giving children to idols like Moloch, God actually says, this is something that would have never come to my mind. And so for Abraham to have actually done that would have been something very opposed to the God of the Bible. So it's just interesting God asked him to do that. Now we'll see later God has a plan here.
How would the descendants come about if he had to kill Isaac?
So we're going to ask that question in just a minute. But that's a good question. And we'll look at, in just a minute, I want to look at why, what would Abraham have been thinking through all of this? I think Hebrews actually gives us a little insight to where his mind is.
He thought God would make him alive again.
Huh? Okay, you just hold on to that thought. We're going that direction. But you're barking up the right tree there. So as we're going through this, another thing too, from my understanding, cultures of the day, though maybe rare, child sacrifice was not unheard of, even at this point. There were cultures who would have done things like that. So he's called to go there to offer his son. And did you go to verse 3? Let's see what Abraham does. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two young men with him and his son Isaac. He cut the wood for the burnt offering and rose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar. So they, you know, there, I've always kind of been fascinated. He got up early in the morning. He wasn't waiting around. He got up and he went. Again, an indication, Abraham has every intention to do what God's called him to do. As I go through this, the more and more I become amazed by it. So they go, it's a three-day trip, so this isn't a short trip either. That's the other thing you got to think about. What would you be doing the whole time you're traveling? I mean, this isn't just like they went down the road a little ways to this mountain and did it. He had 3 days to think about it.
And so they do the travel. Verse
number 5.
Then Abraham said to his
young man, "Stay here while here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you." Interesting what he says there to them. He says, "I will come again. I and the boy will go over there and come again to you." Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife. A couple of interesting parallels we'll note at the end, but just know what's going on. They get to the mountain. I don't know how far they have to climb, but they're going to leave the young men, and it's just going to be him and Isaac. So it's not like he's taking a horde of men with him. It's just him and his son. They're going to climb this mountain. As they do so, who bears the weight of the wood? Isaac. Kind of interesting to note that. And it says he took fire. Now that's probably not that he had a torch that he was carrying up. It's probably a reference to the fact he had the fire-making implements with him, the materials he would create the fire with. and the knife is not a little knife. It's not a little pocket knife. It's a big butcher knife. It would have been pretty large. Not a sword, but a significant weapon or tool for butchering. Okay, and then as they're traveling up, verse 7, Isaac is going to ask a question. Again, I think I'm trying to put myself in Abraham's shoes and how hard this question would have been to hear. But Isaac,
smart
young boy, notices something. Verse 7, Isaac said to his father Abraham, "My father." And he said, "Here I am, I am, my son." He said, "Behold the fire and the wood, but where's the lamb for the burnt offering?" And then verse 8, "God will provide for himself a lamb for a burnt offering, my son." Imagine that. You're saying that to a son whom at least seems, at this moment, Abraham has every belief he's going to do what he has to do. And as even in, when you read Hebrews 11, it seems to me that as he's going up that mountain, he assumes he's going to sacrifice his son. so he says, "God will provide." That's the Hebrew term, Yahweh, Jevev, right? And so they go up, both of them together, the end of verse 8. Verse 9, when they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built the altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. So now you begin, the scriptures building this picture for us. The altar, again, from my understanding, is probably a stacked stone, maybe like a round or oval kind of shape built up off the ground. I don't know how far, but up high enough, they would put the wood on it. And of course, the wood is your fuel for the fire. And then he bound his son. Again, a lot of detail there that's not given to us. Did he have to hold him down to do this? Did his son do this voluntarily? There's nothing in the text to indicate one way or the other, as far as I know. Now, we may make assumptions, but we do need to remember those are assumptions
from the text.
All we know for sure is that Isaac was bound and then laid on the altar. So he binds him, he lays him on the altar on top of the wood. And so that's where he is. I don't know if he's laying there kicking and screaming or if he's there quietly laying there. Now again, just for a minute, you get those two images in your mind. They're both eerie, both terrible, both possibilities. So he lays him down. Verse 10, Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter. That's the English standard. Anybody have a different, what does the King James use there? What?
Slay.
Slaughter, in my mind, it's just a brutal term, right? To slaughter his son. All right, so now, forever in my mind, I've always had the image, it's like the old horror movie, you know, right there, getting ready to come down. I don't know if he's got it up in his hand up above or whether he's walking over, right? We don't know. The text says, again, does not give us all the details here.
We just
know he has the knife in his hand with the intention of fulfilling what God has asked him to do. At some point in the process, the angel of the Lord, again, that phrase there, angel of the Lord, that could be an angel. Sometimes it's God himself. So it's used kind of differently in different contexts. Whoever it is, it's the spokesman of God either way, says to him, Abraham, Abraham. And again, Abraham says, here am I. He said, do not lay your hand on the boy and do anything to him.
For now I know
that you fear God, seeing you have not what? Withheld your son, your only son from me. Abraham, before we get to the end of this, we'll note the aftermath in a second, but just get in that moment for a second. You're Abraham, you have the knife, you hear heaven calling out, don't lay a hand on him. You feel relieved? What's the emotion you feel? I don't know. It doesn't tell us how Abraham felt. But what's God's response? You have not what? I know now that you have not, that you fear God and have not withheld. You know, I can't help but think about the rich young ruler, rich young man, right, who comes to Jesus, what is it that I may do to inherit eternal life? He gives it, you need to follow the commandments. He says, I've done that from my youth. And Jesus says what? One thing you lack, which is what? His wealth. He is unwilling to give his wealth over to God. He's withheld something, hasn't he? There's nothing more important to Abraham than serving God. And I think that's what that statement really means. There's not one thing, there's not one way in which he does not trust God. How do I know that? Well, look at the text. I also have other texts to look at. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 11 as an explanation of what's going on here. Of course, Hebrews 11 has a lot of, describes a lot of men and women of faith. If you get to verse 8, it begins a discussion, a lengthy discussion on Abraham. And it goes through lots of things he did about leaving his homeland, about Sarah and the promise of the birth and holding on to that. But I want to go down to verse 17. So verse 17 and following is what really clues in on Genesis 22. So if I go to Hebrews 11:17, let's read it together. By faith, Abraham, when he was what?
Tried.
The word in the English standard is tested again. when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was in the act of offering up his only son. What, he had bound him and laid him on the altar. He had gotten the knife, right? He was in the act. Of whom it was said, through Isaac shall your offspring be named. Again, the reminder by the Hebrew writer, the promise is all relying on what? On that young man. Everything God had promised Abraham is going to come to him. And so I know a little bit about what's going through Abraham's mind. He has that promise in his mind and in his heart. This young man is the pivot point, or he is the hinge point of everything God's promised me.
And to the world.
And then verse 19. He, Abraham, considered that God was able to raise him from the dead, from which figuratively he did receive him back. What is Hebrews writer saying when he says figuratively he did receive him back?
Abraham already committed the crime of killing his son. In his heart, he was going to do that. And since he was stopped, he would have had the actual same effect if he'd actually done it.
Okay, anybody want to add to that? In Abraham's mind, the way I read this is Abraham had already sacrificed him. He had already done, like, he was so committed to doing what God wanted him to do. In his mind, Isaac was already sacrificed. Well, how could he do that? Well, it goes back. Go back to the first part of that verse. He was what? He considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead. It seems like to me that Abraham, the way he devised how the situation would work out, what would happen? The child would be resurrected. Go ahead, Lisa. Yeah, and that's why these two parallel so well together, these two texts. I think Hebrews really does a good job explaining at least about what's going on with Abraham. And how is he able to do this? Well, he held on to the promise. Isaac's been promised to me, God will not take him away from me forever. I will get him back. And in a way, that's what happened, right? God did resurrect Isaac, symbolically, figuratively. For Abraham, he did, because Abraham saw him as dead. Like, he's dead. God said, no, lift him up. And so in a symbolic sense, he was what? Isaac died and then was resurrected. Does that remind you of something? It's a powerful symbolism here. Shadows. I'm going to go a little bit over. Is that okay? You go ahead and ring it, though. Give me just a couple more minutes. I'm sorry. I can't stop this. This is, to me, this is the most important stuff. Go over, if you will, to James chapter 2. I want you to notice one other thing here about James. Gives us a little bit as well. Sorry, Si. Just don't want to stop this. So James 2, 21. So again, James is talking about what? This chapter is really nailing down into faith, right? Notice verse 21. Was not Abraham, our father, justified by what? By works. When he offered up his son, on the altar. You see that faith was active along with his works, and faith was, this is the English Standard, completed by his works. And the scripture was fulfilled that says, Abraham believed God and it was accounted to him as righteousness, and he was called a friend of God. Again, I think James gives the indication here that, again, he had offered up Isaac. He was committed fully to what God had called him to do. Now, as you can see, and we won't be able to explore all of the parallels, but there are so many parallels between Isaac and Jesus and Abraham and God the Father. If you just kind of consider and line them each and about what each are called to do, right? Abraham was called to offer up his only son, the son of promise. God the Father was called to do what? To offer up his son, the son of the fulfillment of the promise, the true son of promise. Abraham was fully committed in doing what he had to do. And Abraham, in a figurative way, received his son back through resurrection. God offered his son up literally, and literally received him through resurrection. Do you see how one serves as a shadow of the real? Right? The shadow's not the real. Abraham and Isaac are the shadow of the real thing of Jesus. It's so powerful to me. And I also reminded, God does not ask of us what he does not ask of himself. He does not ask more of us than he's given of himself. And just as hard as it was for Jesus to go through and endure what he did, we don't take enough time to think about what the Father had to experience watching every step of the way. And in a figurative sense, the Father was the one who led him to be sacrificed. When Jesus cried, "If there's any way, let this cup pass from me." 3 times he prayed. Every time the Father said, by implication, no. So, powerful stuff, I believe. Any questions or comments? Continue to study it and read it. Did you have a comment you wanted to make, Joe? Oh, yeah, I didn't even get into the wood.
The rock placed on Jesus. He went up the mountains. Jesus went up the Calvary. And so, there's just a tremendous amount.
Yeah, there's so much. I'm glad you said that. I mean, the wood laid on Isaac, the wood that was laid on Jesus, they both were led up the mountain there to be sacrificed.
That's the reason I think Isaac willingly allowed himself to be bound. He freely gave himself to his father. Now, what Abraham explained to Isaac, we don't know. But it wasn't like a 12, 13-year-old boy couldn't outrun a 110-year-old man.
Well, can you imagine the trip home? 3 days together. Dad! Dad! How do you ever discipline your son again? There's another parallel, and I'll say this and I'll shut up. I think this is so beautiful. I'm way over time. Sorry. The other beautiful parallel here is, now take us as a part of this. Not only is Isaac a parallel of Jesus, but he's also a parallel of us. what we are called to do, right? We're called to do what? To sacrifice ourselves. The wood represents what? The wood that he had to bear up the mountain is our sin. The sin we carry around with us that weighs us down. What did that wood have to do? It had to be laid down on the altar and it had to be burned. It had to be purified. We have to voluntarily lay ourselves down on the altar. We have to willingly sacrifice our wants, our desires, to do what God's called us to do. Again, there's so many beautiful parallels between these, but just as Isaac was received back in a figurative sense, in our baptism, we are figuratively received back, as Romans 6, verse 4 says, as a new creation in Christ. And so I just think this is such a wonderful text. And again, we could spend forever. Thank you for your extra time. I try not to do that next time. But I just really, this to me is one of the key cornerstones of Scripture and how it shadows what we see in the Gospels with Jesus. Any other questions or comments? All right. Anybody not able to partake of the Lord's Supper today? I don't see any hands. Again, it's good to be here. Thank you so much for taking the time to come and take part in the study. Brother Turner, would you mind closing us with a prayer?